Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics, and in this episode, I'm going to be covering digital IDs. Now, I recently covered central bank digital currencies, and that for me is probably my main topic, the thing that I push back on more than most things. But actually, digital IDs are the other side of that same coin. You really need a digital ID in order to enable the more Orwellian aspects of what a central bank digital currency can do. And actually, a central bank digital currency, even out of the picture, a digital ID can be a social credit system. It can stop you from doing a huge range of things in society. It can stop you from getting a job, attending a school, going to a shop, a supermarket, a store, you know, playing for a sport. It could basically cut you out of large sections of society, as people in Canada found for much of the last year, when they were excluded from trains and planes if they weren't vaccinated. And of course, to this day, we can't travel to the United States if we're not vaccinated, because we don't have the requirement in this proto social credit system that we still have operating around the world. So knowing that I wanted to talk about digital IDs, it makes sense to reach out to Nick Corbishley. Now, he wrote this book, Scanned. He wrote that in 2021, and I read it in early 2022 when it first came out. And I have to give a bit of a trigger warning on this one. It's a good book. You should go out and buy it, and we'll add the link to the reading list. But I do have to give a bit of a trigger warning, because it really takes you back reading this book. I read it then. I read it again yesterday in preparation for this interview. And it reminds you of the utterly horrible way that governments treated us back in 2000 and 2001, especially those of us who were unvaccinated, the way we were othered and treated as essentially vermin. We had lots of characters in the public sphere openly calling us vermin and an underclass and people who needed to be dealt with. Even the people who were polite about it, like Macron, said that he wanted to piss off the unvaccinated, amongst many other unpleasant treatment that the governments attempted to take the frustration and the rage of having these impositions imposed on them, and they wanted to transfer them to a group within society, which is the nature of what government do. I'm just going to read you a small section from the book before we get Nick on. So I'm reading from page 156. In the last month alone, I have watched media commentators calling for censorship of their political opponents, philosophy professors justifying mass internment, and human rights lobby groups remaining silent about vaccine passports. I have watched much of the political left transition into the openly authoritarian movement it probably already was, and countless liberals campaigning against liberty, as freedom after freedom has been taken away, and I have watched as intellectual after intellectual justified it all. He goes on to say, this is not about whether you've been vaccinated or not, or how many times you have been vaccinated. It's about whether you are willing to give up all agency over your own life. We are being told to give up virtually everything that matters, our freedom to associate with whoever we choose, to move around, and not just from country to country, but within our own countries, even within our own cities, to express ourselves freely, to inform and think for ourselves and protest government corruption or abuse or overreach, to decide for ourselves what experimental medical products go into our bodies, all in return for virtually nothing. And there are many sections like that as he catalogues the treatment that government dished out to us. Now, a lot of that, of course, are things that governments have backed off from. They were getting themselves into the situation by late 2021, 2022, where they were on the verge of having to start mass internment campaigns. You look at countries like Austria, which had brought in incredibly strict vaccine mandates. They were going to impose very significant fines on people who remained unvaccinated, well beyond the means of most people to afford, which would have resulted in a huge number of people not being able to pay these fines. And back then, I did a tweet thread where I basically ran the numbers, and I looked at the number of people who were refusing to comply with these edicts. And I made certain assumptions about how many, when push really came to shove, would fold and go against what they wanted to do and comply with having the experimental product injected into them, and how many wouldn't. And basically it came down to Western European countries having to build many, many tens of thousands of internment camps to put people on. And Austria walked up to that line. They actually backed off from a lot of this stuff on the day before that the most Orwellian and most draconian aspects of this legislation that we're experiencing was due to go into effect, because they had to. So we have rode back on a lot of the stuff that was done to us back over that period. But nevertheless, a precedent has been set. Infrastructure, digital infrastructure was built and will continue to be built upon. This book describes the mechanisms that were used and abused by governments. And the lockdown scandal is a very recent yet very powerful example of how government overreach, using what we called at the time vaccine passports, but were really just a nascent social credit system, a proto-digital ID. Those can come back. It is a threat that remains very viable. It's just waiting for the next hysteria, whatever that may be, whatever may be getting planned to come down the line. So it is so important that we're aware of what's going on about this. I know that Nick has been thinking about it. I do highly recommend the book, even though it is quite painful to go back and remind ourselves of what we all had to so recently experience. Nick has been thinking about these issues, so I've been looking for an opportunity to have a conversation with him. So I'm delighted we're going to be having him on in a few moments. And I want to put to him how this has developed since and what I think we all need to be looking out for and getting Nick's take on all of this stuff. So I hope you enjoy this special episode with Nick Corbishley, and let's cut to the interview. So Nick, thank you so much for coming on Brokenomics. I was just explaining to the audience how I reread your book yesterday, having read it when it first came out, and I needed to give my audience a bit of a trigger warning, because it was so painful being taken back to those sort of 2000 and 2021 years and the way we were treated. It's a really important book, but really difficult, the sort of subject matter that you were covering. Now there was one passage in particular that really made me want to reach out for you for a show like this. On page 112, you wrote this: "The elites are fully aware that the Ponzi scheme of the late stage capitalism, built on the foundations of unpayable levels of public and private debt, will soon crash. Before that happens, they are trying to usher in a neo-feudal society, which, if they can, will continue to hold most of the wealth and power." Now that, in a nutshell, that is the thesis of Brokenomics, and you just said it so well there. So absolutely brilliant to have you on.
Yeah, thanks Dan. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be with you, and yeah, it's weird to hear somebody read my book back to me, because it's been so long. So much has happened.
Well, you say so long, but I mean it's only a sort of year ago. I think we're sort of shutting it out in our minds, because it was just such a painful period, the othering that went on, sort of the hostility. And I think you described it very well, is they wanted to take the frustration that we all felt for the measures that they were imposing on us, and they wanted to turn us against each other, which they actually managed to do quite successfully in the end. But you're right, things have changed quite a lot. Do you think that they perhaps screwed up because they pushed too hard?
I think that they are aware of the risks of going too far, and they're quite competent, quite capable of shifting back a step or two when necessary. I think that they, so it's like a lot of what they're doing right now is they're throwing out trial balloons and they're seeing what works, what gets accepted. And I think that because they have so much control over the media, especially the mainstream media, but as we've seen over the last month or so with all the things coming out about Twitter, also the social media, it's very hard to get a strong, consistent message about what is really happening to us. And I think that that is kind of like the most frustrating thing. Even though we've been through what we've been through, what I fear most is that Based on my interactions with people I know, people, rather than reflecting on what's happened, they prefer to think about, let's just put it
block
behind
it off.
Us.
Yeah,
it's block it off. And I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I know that if you have a serious trauma in your past, the worst thing you can do is just bury it under a rug and hope it never presents itself at some point.
Because that's actually a connection you made in the book. And you talked about how digital IDs, as much as anything, they're a tool of psychological conditioning on the populace, as well as a technical infrastructure. I mean, how did you develop that argument?
Well, I mean, I thought that when I started writing the book, I mean, I wrote the book in about three and a half months because I was given a very, very short deadline because of just the pace of events. We realized that by the time we wrote the book, by the time we published the book, sorry, by the time I wrote the book, by the time we published the book, it was going to, there was a risk that it was going to be, you know, things would have moved on so much. So there was, and there was a fear that, you know, because of the seriousness, the gravity of the situation, it needed to be out there as quickly as possible. So I had about 3.5 months to write it. And the truth is, I mean, like there, at that time, the only thing that I could think of as viable justification for vaccine passports, bearing in mind that even by kind of like, we're talking about July, August, 2021, it was clear that they were not working in terms of cutting transmission, which is the only possible justification for having vaccine passports. And once you accept that fact, then the only way to extrapolate is that there's something else going on.
I mean, I would say even if the vaccines worked perfectly, they were not justified, because it does not take away from me the simple right for me just to say no, that I do not want something injected into my body. Because, you know, let's say these vaccines worked absolutely perfectly, and of course it is increasingly clear that that claim, to say the very least, has substantial holes in it. If you've abrogated the right, then that means that the government can come along the following year and say, well, now this is going to go in your body as well. And it's, of course, and it's not just vaccines. This conversation started about vaccines, but I'm always keen to remind people that we've already had a social credit system in this country and across most of Western Europe. It was just a social credit system that had one flag on it. But there's no reason why it couldn't have had another flag added to it, you know, that you are not a purveyor of hate speech, and, you know, whoever gets to define that, or that you criticised your government, or you've done some other aspect. So, you know, the vaccines themselves, they're very much a sort of Trojan horse, weren't they? It's the control wanted.
Yes. Yeah, I think the vaccine passports are a digital identity, a fairly one-dimensional digital identity, because they're only about one thing, really. But once people accepted this idea that, you know, in order to access basic services, in order to be able to enjoy even the most basic rights, the ability to move around, the ability to leave your home in some places, once you accept that the government can decide that for you, then you know you are on an extremely slippery slope, and the precedent has been set. And I felt that the really scary thing about vaccine passports is the ease with which so many people accepted it. And I think that in the UK was, I think, on one end of a spectrum, which is kind of like more reluctant. The more reluctant end of the spectrum. They were not keen largely on this. But I mean, like, if, you know, in parts of Europe, people just accepted it as what was necessary.
Did you also notice there was a fairly worrying generational gap in the pushback as well? Because, you know, we can't generalise, because, of course, lots of individuals are very different, but by and large, the boomer generation were the targets of this fear. And I saw actually most of the pushback coming from Gen X. You know, the millennials and below, they just didn't seem to care or connect with any of this stuff.
No, I mean, I think that this is something that makes what is happening right now kind of really quite disturbing, which is that normally in times of extreme government repression, the pushback normally comes from the younger generations, the people who have the energy, the people who are more likely to be rebellious by nature, and the people who are, should we say, less invested in the system. Whereas what we saw, and I saw it with my own eyes, my wife and I participated in a couple of demonstrations against vaccine passports in Barcelona. And, you know, they were not huge, should we say, hugely attended. There were probably about 2,000-3,000 people in each of these marches. But I walked the length of the march each time, and just to see with my own eyes what kind of people were participating. And by and large, they were people in their 40s and 50s. Some people older. But it was almost impossible to find people in their 20s. And there were very few people in their 30s. The irony is that both of these marches took place on a Saturday afternoon in the middle of Barcelona, which meant that you had loads of people shopping. And what I did notice is you had loads of people who were in their 20s, you know, we're talking about Generation Z, the millennials. They were coming out of their shops and they were filming us as if we were a spectacle. And I thought that said quite a lot about what we're up against. I think that younger generations, in a sense, are more trusting of the technological trends that we're on. Perhaps they're less questioning of the risk of government oppression, government overreach, because they are three or four generations removed from, should we say, darker times. I don't know. It's very strange to watch.
And perhaps it's not just that aspect as well. When you talk in your book about an experiment, I think it was in Scotland, about how in order to access, was it lunch, they had to scan their faces. I mean, are you seeing more examples of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean that I've not looked for the last few months, but I mean, like, despite massive pushback from parents, and I think this actually went viral, at least in Scotland, I'm not sure if in the UK as in general, but there was significant.
So describe that process. What were school children having to do?
Okay, so I can't remember exactly which region of Scotland it was. This has been a while, but it was one county in Scotland, and it had basically decided to roll out a trial program it was a number of schools. If I'm not mistaken, it was secondary and primary schools, but it may just have been secondary schools. Basically, the idea was to make the school lunch queue go faster. So for reasons of expedience, they were going to basically ask children to use their faces to transact. So rather than using cash, so I mean, this has two elements to it. So no more cash. And on the other hand, you know, you have, you know, this idea of having to use your part of your body, in this case, your face, in order to be able to transact.
So it's biometrics effectively.
It's biometric payment system, which right now my MasterCard is working on. Is piloting a system in the UK for biometric payment system, just using, I think it's hand and face. But yes, the fact that they're doing this with children, I think it was, you know, as young as primary age, but it was certainly secondary school children. And the fact they're doing this, and it's about conditioning children, very young people, to accept this incredible intrusion. I mean, when you're 11 years old,
you just go with the flow, don't you? Yeah.
You go with the flow. You do not question the moral or ethical implications.
Yeah.
You trust authority. And
look, we're all used to examples. It happens all of the time of a big card company or financial institution or somebody who gets hacked, the data gets taken. We're all used to that sort of thing happening. Is it different when it's biometric data that's being fed into this machine and is potentially going to get hacked?
Well, it's completely different. It's completely different because you cannot change it. Once it has been hacked, once it has been leaked, once that information is no longer secure, you know, if you lose your credit cards, you just ask for a new one. If you forget your PIN, you ask for a new one. It's something that can get changed You can block a credit card. You cannot block your fingerprints. You cannot, you know, again, it's the same with your face print. I mean, like, all of these things are fundamental to you. They are your most fundamental
identifiers. And it feels like we're right on the cusp of governments and private sector organizations, some of the larger ones, from building these enormous resources of data on people. And I think you describe it as a honeypot of data that is clearly going to become a target for people.
And if you look at the fine print, if you look at what some of the institutions are saying, whether it's governmental, whether it's banks, whether it's central banks, they do have these caveats in there saying, like, yeah, we're not completely sure just how secure this data is, particularly with regard to, for example, hacks or cyber attacks. But it's like that is a secondary concern compared to the, I would say, the profit potential and the control potential that these technologies offer. So it's like that's something we'll deal with down the line. And we've seen this in India. I mean, India, you know, India has the largest digital identity, biometric enabled digital identity scheme on the planet with I think it's like 1.4 billion people's profiles amassed in this huge system. And, you know, this was developed over a period of years. It kind of like was more or less complete by 2018. And I think it was last August or something, or July or August, where they actually started warning people, whatever you do, don't take photocopies of your Aadhaar number. The system is called Aadhaar. Because it could be used against you. And it's like, well, that is your most private. So it raised serious flags, raised serious questions about the security of the system. And then it was very quickly shushed up. And there have been so many red flags raised about this system in India and so many examples of hacks.
So India does have certainly some pretty brutal poverty in this Aadhaar system. Am I right in thinking that that's linked to welfare and food programs that they have? Is that something that you've looked at? I mean, how functional has that been? Have people been shut off through accidents or mistakes or oversight?
Yeah, I mean, like in the rollout. So, I mean, like, I think that even now, you know, 4 or 5 years after it went live, there's still hundreds of millions, or should I say tens of millions of people who are still not registered in the system. And those people do not have access to government programs, government services, etc.
And you talked previously about sort of conditioning school children to accept this sort of stuff, but there's a flip side to that as well, which is the bureaucrat who's handing it out on a paper-based system, on a faulty system where people know people, they look in each other's faces, that they, you can use workarounds. You can say, okay, well, look, clearly you're entitled to this, and so we're not going to let you go hungry, which is a real issue in some of the slums that you've got in India. But when it's a computer system that is simply computer says no, you remove that human element from it, and you can have basically people being just completely shut out the system.
This happened to many people. Mm. I mean, like, there were dozens. I mean, in a country like India, people dying of starvation or not getting basic medical access to basic medical assistance, these sort of people will just fall through the cracks. Mm. But there are certainly at least 100 cases that have been documented of people who died as a result of not having access to the system. And yes, there's something that I think. I mean, there's so many concerns about this, about the potential it has to create this kind of authoritarian system above us. But there's also this risk of this kind of like arbitrarian system being developed, where Kafkaesque things begin to happen. And suddenly, even if you have been completely law-abiding, you've ticked all the boxes, you've done everything you're supposed to do, because of a problem in the system, you suddenly find yourself kind of like locked out. And that is another terrifying element of this. I mean, for me, there's such a long list. I mean, but that is one area. The other area is just basic risk of failure, systemic failure. We've had so many reminders over the past year of the fragility of our power system, the fragility of our telecommunication systems. We've had massive outages in Canada. We've had massive outages in Australia. But each time these outages happen, they're kind of like used as an excuse. So we just need to tinker around a little bit and everything will be okay. And it's almost like used as an excuse to accelerate the process rather than to actually sit back and reflect and say,
And of course, to come full circle to where we started, the big excuse for accelerating a lot of this stuff was the vaccine passports, although it obviously goes deeper than that. But and that was really when I think most people became aware of the issues around digital IDs.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.